Well, welcome back, everybody. My name is David Mitra, in case you've never met me before. Quick word for Subhadra Mata before we start. The door, the exit isn't secure, so remind me in case I forget to have a word with Jaika afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah. This thing seems to be jammed in some way.
Okay.
Right. Ha. Hot in here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ooh. I sometimes get hot flushes, believe it or not. As you can see, I'm not a menopausal woman, but I'm on hormone therapy. I'm on hormone therapy for cancer, and that induces hot flushes frequently. So when the temperature's like it is, like it's going to be over the next few days, that's going to be quite a trial for my resistance to the heat. Never mind. So this evening, I'm going to be exploring another one of the wonderful qualities of the ocean, as explored by the Buddha in this famous sutta. But before I get directly onto that, I want to tell a story. There'll be a story that some of you will be familiar with already. You've probably heard it many times, some of you. But it's the story of Bahia, and I'm going to tell it for a very particular reason, which links in with the theme of the evening, which I'm not quite going to let you know what it is just yet. So keep you on tenterhooks just a little bit longer. So Bahia actually is described in the text as Bahia of the bark garment, which always amuses me every time this image of Bahia and the bark garment comes to mind, is I get the idea of someone somehow walking around inside a tree trunk. Ridiculous, really, but that's the sort of image it conjures up to my literal mind. Perhaps more poetically, one might regard it as, you know, a figure rather like the Ents, if you know the Lord of the Rings. But anyway, Bahia wasn't an Ent, he was a human being. But Bahia lived or was staying in a place called Suparika. Now, Suparika is an ancient port on the west coast of India, not far from modern-day Bombay. And while he was staying at Suparika, the thought occurred to him, he just wondered, am I one of those in the world who is an arahant? That is to say, enlightened, someone who's realized the ultimate truth. So clearly he was a man who was concerned about gaining enlightenment, or at least coming to the realization of the ultimate truth. And very conveniently, it just happened that a devatar, a sort of god figure, not like, you know, God Almighty, just a god, a lesser god, a minor god, who was a relative, according to the text, of Bahia in a previous life, said, no, Bahia, you're not one of the enlightened. However, don't worry, in Sravasti, which is actually a long way from Suparika or modern-day Bombay, if you went there by train, it would take about at least 2 days, there's an enlightened being in Sravasti. Go and see him. So, clearly, Bahia was a man very strongly motivated and had quite a sense of urgency. So he decided to go straight from Suparika to Sravasti to try and meet the Buddha, with, of course, the idea of asking the Buddha for a teaching. So he travelled, apparently very, very quickly, all the way from Suparika to Sravasti in search of the Buddha. And, of course, the only way he could have got there was by walking. It's quite a long walk. But anyway, he did arrive eventually in Sravasti, found out that the Buddha was staying, well, he arrived in the place the Buddha was actually staying, called the Jeta Grove, went to the Jeta Grove, asked the monks there, where's the Buddha? I need to talk with the Buddha. So they told him that the Buddha was on his arms round in Sravasti. So Bahia didn't bother to hang about. He went straight into Sravasti in search of the Buddha. He eventually found him in the middle of his arms round, approached him and asked him for a teaching. Of course, first of all, he bowed down, paid his respects, etc., etc. Then he asked the Buddha for a teaching, just like that. But the Buddha was in the middle of his arms round, so he couldn't just stop. At least his habit was not to just stop in the middle of an arms round and start teaching people. It wasn't the right time. And he said, you come unseasonably, Bahia. Come another time. But Bahia, being a man of great sense of urgency, was not satisfied with that and said, look, we don't know how long you're going to live or how long I'm going to live. By the time you teach me, I might be dead, or you might not live long enough to teach me. So please teach me. So the Buddha said, Bahya, you come unseasonably, come at another time. So again, Bahya asked the Buddha for a third time. And of course, if you ever ask the Buddha up to the third time, he will answer. So on the spot, he gave Bahya a teaching, a very, very simple teaching. I'm not going to explain it because that's not really my purpose this evening, but I'm more concerned about what happened next. The Buddha explained this very, very simple teaching. You must train yourself thus. Bahya listened, and immediately he gained enlightenment. Immediately he gained enlightenment. Now, Bahya is very famous in Buddhist tradition for having been, the most famous of the Buddhist disciples, because he was the fastest to enlightenment. Not even Sariputra was as quick as Bahya. Bahya gained enlightenment, not just stream entry, for those of you who know what stream entry is, but enlightenment, full enlightenment on the spot, just by being given a very simple teaching by the Buddha. Of course, when we read the words in the translation of the original text, it doesn't have that sort of impact upon us. Of course, one has to bear in mind that this was a communication between an enlightened human being, the Buddha, and an unenlightened human being who was very eager and very open to what the Buddha had to say. There's a lot more that could be said about that, and I'll probably say something more a little bit later. But for the moment, the key thing to remember is that the Buddha taught Bahya. Bahya gained enlightenment on the spot. Okay. Now, why that might be significant will become apparent later. In the meantime, I need to explore the ocean. And I'm going to read you directly from the text, not from Bhante's lecture, but from the text that he quotes in the lecture. So it's taken from a text called Udana, which, as Subhadramati mentioned earlier, is a very, very ancient text. So, you know, it's one of those texts which takes us about as close to the Buddha, what the Buddha might actually have taught. It's about as close as we're likely to get. So it's a very, very important text, therefore, from that point of view. So the Buddha says, just as, brethren, the mighty ocean deepens and slopes gradually down, hollow after hollow, not plunging by a sudden precipice, even so, brethren, in this Dhamma Vinaya, the training is gradual. Progress is gradual. It goes step by step. There is no sudden penetration to insight. Okay? So that last statement is particularly important. There is no sudden penetration to insight. So it's really important to get these words imprinted deeply within your minds. So now what we're going to do, we come to the point that you've all been waiting for: audience participation. Okay? So listen carefully. There is no sudden penetration to insight. Got it? Okay. Repeat after me. There is no sudden penetration to insight. Oh, come on, that's so half-hearted. You can do better than that. Again.
There is no sudden penetration to insight.
That's better, but it's still not good enough. Again.
There is no sudden penetration to insight.
That'll do for the moment. We might come back to it. Depends how well you behave. So, right, so, it would seem, so this is the quality of the great quality of the ocean I'm going to explore this evening. Now, first, of course, I must explain something which you've probably already realized. Actually, the ocean doesn't endlessly slope down gradually. Sooner or later, it does come to a precipice, a sudden precipice, and you know, it goes very, very deep, very, very quickly, several miles down. So, but of course, the Buddha didn't know that at the time. The Buddha was not omniscient. He didn't know everything. He wasn't God Almighty, thank goodness. He wasn't omniscient. He was omniscient when it came to knowing what conduced to enlightenment and what did not, but he didn't know everything. He didn't know every tiny thought of your minds, ending like that. He simply knew what conduced to enlightenment and what did not, but he didn't know the fact that there was a flaw in this metaphor. Never mind, we'll ignore that. We'll pretend that we don't know that actually it's not quite like that. So the Buddha says the ocean floor slopes gradually. And the point he's making here is that is what the training is like. The Buddhist training. It's a gradual process, a gradual realization. Now, I've lost my tack for a moment. Let me just think. I have to explain, I'm frequently affected by mental fatigue because of the drugs I'm on, because of cancer treatment. However, I'll get there. Let me take a quick look. Yes, so the Buddha's training is gradual. And to emphasize this point, there are a number of instances where the Buddha spelt this out. There's another famous occasion when he gave what became known as the exposition of the thoroughbred colt. And what he describes is the process by which a colt is trained to become a perfectly governable and well-behaved horse. And he says, first of all, the horse has to get used to the bit. It doesn't like the bit to start with. In fact, it hates it, tries to spit it out, but it can't. It just has to get used to it. Eventually, it does get used to it, and it doesn't mind having the bit. Then it has to get used to the saddle. And at first, it tries to throw the saddle off, but it can't, because it's strapped on well. Gradually, it gets used to the saddle and feels perfectly at home when the saddle is put on. Then it has to learn how to trot. Then it has to learn how to canter, how to gallop, etc., etc., until in the end it can perform all these miraculous, well, wonderful tricks that the perfect horse owned by a king has to perform. So that's how you train a thoroughbred colt. The training is gradual. You just introduce it bit by bit to the next step, like going on retreat. And of course, very often when we come into contact with something new, well, not very often, well, maybe very often actually, yes, we might react to it a little bit. Part of us, at least, doesn't like, you know, the discipline that we're being introduced to or whatever, and rebel against it. But gradually, we get used to the new sort of. The new discipline, and we eventually become quite at home with it and get on with it without even thinking about it. So the training, the Buddhist training, is like that, according to, well, not only the metaphor about the ocean, but this metaphor involving the thoroughbred colt. Now, at this point, of course, the more discernible amongst you might have noticed that there seems to be a contradiction. So what's the contradiction?
Not the others immediately enlightened, but the same sun penetration.
Sorry?
That Bahia was immediately enlightened, but there's no sun penetration.
Exactly. So what's going on? Is the Buddha actually contradicting himself?
No.
Sorry?
Ah,
oh, well, well, thank you for your answer. We'll see later on whether you're right or not. That's enough audience participation for the moment. Okay, so, well, at least on the face of it, it seems that there's a contradiction, doesn't there? Because Bahia went to the Buddha, almost demanded a teaching. The Buddha eventually conceded, gave him a teaching. He gained enlightenment on the spot. But remember, nobody else did that. He was the only one. Only Bahia did that. But even so, what one human being can do, in principle, so can any other. So the sort of seeming paradox remains. However, we'll explore that later on. We'll come back to Bahia later. So it is interesting because you have the idea, or these two ideas, that realization, the realization of enlightenment, or even just of insight, is something which is sudden. Or that it's actually, no, it's gradual. It's a gradual sort of development. And this became quite a big issue in the relatively early history of Buddhism in China. So that what happened was that two schools developed. They were known, surprisingly, as the sudden school and the gradual school. And of course, they were at loggerheads with each other. One school was asserting that the approach to enlightenment was, that realization was sudden. The other school was asserting that, no, it's not sudden, it's gradual. As it happened, the sort of two patriarchs of these particular schools, who had no issue with each other about the fact that the schools that they had established had been associated with this particular approach. It was only their disciples that were at loggerheads with each other. And so there's quite a bit of dispute about it. And on one occasion, one confused layman went to see the sixth patriarch, very famous patriarch, sixth patriarch of the Chan school of Buddhism, Hui Neng, who was in fact the head of the so-called Southern School, also known as the Southern School. As it happened, the gradual school was known as the Northern School, because one school was in the north and one school was in the south. Anyway, this layman was rather confused, because he'd heard both, you know, that realization was gradually heard, also that it was sudden. So he asked Hui Neng, please, you know, could you elaborate on this? So I'm going to read you Hui Neng's response to this man. Okay. So far as the Dharma is concerned, there can be only one school. If a distinction is made, it exists in the fact that the founder of one school was a northern man and the founder of the other was a southern man. While there is only one system of Dharma, some disciples realize it quicker than others. But the reasons why the names sudden and gradual are given is because some disciples are superior to others in their mental dispositions. So far as the Dharma is concerned, the distinction of sudden and gradual does not exist. Now, I don't know whether this helps us or not in trying to understand what the issue is, but here Hui Neng, of course, uses language which is now rather emotionally charged. It wouldn't have been, of course, at the time that this text was composed. The idea of superiority and inferiority. But we can look at this differently. We can look at it in terms of the fact that if you acknowledge that there is a path to enlightenment, there's a sort of a training that you go through, that some people will be at earlier stages and others will be at later stages of training along that path. In other words, some people will be closer and some people will be further away. Now, it's not anything that anyone can assert against anybody else. It's just a fact. Some people have a better understanding, let's say a deeper understanding, a deeper experience than others. Some people are kinder or more, let's say, even more mindful than others. Some people are more generous than others, and so on. I think we can see this if we just look around us and see how different human individuals are. But I think it's important to acknowledge that in a certain sense, certainly in a spiritual context, we're not all completely equal. In a sense, we are, in that we all equally have the capacity for ultimately gaining enlightenment. Whatever our background is, whatever our conditioning is, whatever our nationality, race, etc., all have the capacity ultimately for gaining enlightenment. In fact, even in Mahayana Buddhism, it goes beyond that. It says all sentient beings ultimately have the capacity to gain enlightenment. But nonetheless, there are going to be beings who are at different stages of that path, who therefore are a bit more experienced, have a deeper understanding than others. Presumably, that's why, hopefully, some of you come here. You think that those of us who sit here and give talks have perhaps just a little bit more understanding and experience than you yourselves have. Otherwise, why would you bother to come? And it's a good thing, actually, that some of us, at least, have been at it a bit longer than others. I've been practicing the Dharma now for 47 years. I've been ordained for over 45 years. So I've got a reasonable amount of experience. And hopefully, you can benefit from that. But that partly depends upon you, and also depends upon me. Can I communicate my experience? If I can communicate my experience, can you receive it? All sorts of unknown factors have their part to play in all this. But anyway, the point is that if you have a path which is made up of stages, which is a process of gradual realization, there'll be some who are further along that path than others. Okay? Now, let's come back to Bahia. Okay, so now I'm going to test you. What did I say? What did the Buddha say about realization? I quite catch that. Could one person boldly speak it out?
There is no sudden penetration to insight.
Thank you. Okay, once more. It's got to be good this time.
There is no sudden penetration to insight.
Getting better. Okay. So we're coming back to Bahia. So there is no sudden penetration to insight, the Buddha says. And yet here's Bahia gaining enlightenment on the spot. So it seems on the face of it to be very sudden. But is it? I suppose that's the question. The question, and really what that points to, is Bahia's backstory. What's his history? Well, of course, we don't know very much about Bahia. The fact that he wore a bark garment suggests, perhaps, that he had some kind of shamanic background, because apparently shamans used to weave cloth from the fibers of certain barks because they had magical qualities. So perhaps Bahia had been a shaman of some description. Anyway, that's one possibility. But even if he wasn't, he clearly was a man who had a deep sense of some kind of the possibility of some kind of higher realization, and it was very, very important to him. It was so important that at a time when there wasn't even rail travel across India, he travelled all the way from Suparaka to Shravasti to encounter the Buddha. He was that desperate. So he had a very, very strong motivation. So how does someone have such a powerful motivation as to do something of that sort? Well, I suppose you have to sort of consider things in the biggest possible perspective. And if you have any knowledge or understanding about Buddhism at all, you will understand that Buddhism teaches that there's more than one life. That there's, you know, we're not just here on this one occasion, that life continues endlessly as we pursue, we just sort of wander through world after world, life after life, throughout the samsara. There's an endless cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. So, if you find that someone over a series of lifetimes has been practicing the Dharma, well, in the present life, they're likely to be a bit further along the path than somebody who hasn't. Now, this is a sort of idea which is not easy for a lot of Westerners to stomach, really, but it's very much part of Buddhist tradition. For example, the Buddha himself is spoken of in the tradition as having practiced as a bodhisattva for many lifetimes before he gained full enlightenment. Now, whether you however literally you take that, or metaphorically, it's entirely up to you. But the fact is, certainly I'm personally convinced that they're well convinced. I believe it's more likely than not that, you know, that we do, as it were, move from life to life through this cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. It's very much part of Buddhist teaching. So the explanation about Bahia would be simply, quite simply, that, well, probably he had some sort of background of that sort. Maybe in a previous life, in several previous lives, he'd been trying to realize the ultimate truth. So so when you see it in that sort of perspective, this seeming contradiction between sudden and gradual disappears. And of course, if we go back to Huineng, the sixth patriarch of the Chan tradition, he makes it quite clear that it's actually an artificial distinction. That whole sort of dispute in China at that time, I'm not sure whether it came to it, it was resolved through Huineng, probably it was, I can't remember the history precisely, but it was ultimately resolved in a very Chinese, characteristically Chinese way by them realizing, well, that actually the approach to realization is gradual, but the realization itself is sudden. A very neat way out of the difficulty. So if I look back, say, over the course of my life, it seems to me that since I've been practicing the Dharma now for 47 years, it seems to me that I have made some progress in those 47 years. Enough, anyway, to satisfy me that the Dharma actually works. I'm certainly not enlightened. I've got a lot of work still to do. I think I've probably got many, many lives yet to work through. But I've changed. I've changed significantly to convince me that the Dharma actually works. It's a gradual process, and the realization of insight is a gradual process, as the Buddha asserts in that metaphor regarding the gradual sloping of the ocean. There is no sudden, what is it? There's no sudden sudden realization to insight. Is that right? There's no sudden penetration to insight, yes. I think insight is something which dawns very, very gradually. And it dawns because we have a whole range of practices which complement each other and which ultimately are pointing in that direction. And I think it's important to bear that in mind, because you probably find some people who say, well, actually, you know, it's not that big a deal. You can gain insight relatively easily. And there are all sorts of methods of inquiry which may help you do that. But I think that, in a way, that's quite, it's a potentially quite dangerous sort of approach, because for two reasons. First of all, there's a danger that you overlook the fact that ethics is very important in the Dharma life, and that ethics, a foundation of ethics, is absolutely indispensable when it comes to realizing anything, within a Buddhist context anyway. You're probably all familiar, well, many of you will be familiar, perhaps all of you are familiar with the most fundamental teaching of, or, well, the simplest sort of exposition of the path, which breaks it down into three stages: ethics, sila, meditation, samadhi, and prajna, wisdom. And if you what I like to sort of regard this teaching as a kind of a pyramid. You know, at the base of the pyramid, you've got the ethics. And the ethics are absolutely vital as a support to the development of meditation. If you've got a severely guilty conscience, it's going to be very difficult to focus your mind. You're not going to be able to meditate easily, to use an obvious example. So ethics are absolutely vital. They form the base of that pyramid. In the middle, you've got meditation. So the ethics supports the meditation. The meditation is the necessary foundation for the gradual realization of wisdom or insight. So that's how it works. So if you dispense with ethics, if you ignore ethics, well, you're not likely to realize very much. Now, there are all sorts of exercises that you can engage in, which actually might be quite useful. For example, you might be told to start examining your experience and seeing if you can find or locate the self. And if you actually try to do that, you probably discover fairly quickly that you can't. It's not a difficult thing to do. It's not a difficult thing to realise. But it's very difficult to sort of really penetrate that to its depths. It's easy to understand that intellectually, but to understand it from the depths of your being is a very different matter. I think quite a few of you know, about 5 years ago, I completed a 9-month solitary retreat. It wasn't the first solitary retreat I'd done in my life. I've done solitary retreats really almost since my first year of ordination, usually for about a month, on one occasion for 3 months, and then finally I did a 9-month retreat. And the most shocking thing that I experienced during those 9 months happened, I should think, probably roughly halfway through. And it was very, very simple. I was just sitting doing nothing, as I did quite a bit, doing absolutely nothing, just trying to sort of stay with my immediate experience. And, well, what happened, it's very difficult to describe, but it was as if suddenly there was a hiatus in something. It's as if something suddenly stopped. Not for long. I'm talking probably about milliseconds. But what then happened was there was a sort of disconnect between a very, very powerful force and my immediate experience. So I'll explain what I think that was. Bear in mind this, that according to Buddhist analysis, what drives the whole of samsaric existence are three poisons: greed, hatred, and delusion. So our ultimate goal is to overcome these three poisons and develop the very positive qualities of love, generosity, and contentment. So that's clarity of mind. So that's the goal. But what drives us are these three poisons. And very often you'll hear people talk about the ego and overcoming the ego. And yes, it's true. Buddhism teaches us ultimately how to overcome what we refer to as the ego. But the question arises, but what is the ego? How do you know what the ego is? I mean, people describe sometimes themselves, sometimes as others as being very egotistical and so on and so forth. But actually, we are all ego-driven. And the driving force that ultimately we have to overcome is identified as ego-clinging or self-clinging. So when I was on my long retreat, what it seemed to me happened was that because I'd been alone for several months, by degrees, very, very slowly, so that I didn't really notice what was going on, my mind quietened down more and more and more and more. And so in one of my quieter moments, and there were other things similar went on, but this particular experience was particularly shocking. In one of these quiet moments, it seemed as if perhaps, you know, there was a disconnect between ego clinging and immediate experience. So what then happened was a huge reaction. And I felt almost as if there was a tremendous force driving me forward to desperately identify with that experience. And it was all over in a moment. But it really shook me. And I felt, now I know what ego clinging is. I'm not saying I have overcome ego clinging. I certainly haven't. I haven't even begun to. But at least I think I know. I've got some sense of what ego clinging is. And it's a very, very powerful force. It's not the sort of thing that you can stop dead in its tracks. Certainly thinking and trying to find out, well, where is the self in my experience, and realizing, well, I can't find one. That's not going to stop that. It needs something much, much deeper. Quite what that is difficult to say. But it seems to me that that's the task that all of us ultimately are faced with. We have to somehow uncover this force, identify it, and then begin to see how to deal with it. Now, this experience, if you like, came after I've been practicing Dharma for well over 40 years. And that's no accident. The fact is, I've been practicing meditation pretty much for every day of those 40-odd years. I've been making an effort to practice ethics right from the beginning. Ethics was always very important to me. I mean, I felt I wanted to become a better human being. I still want to become a better human being. That hasn't changed. I think I'm a better human being than I was, but I still got a heck of a lot long way, along, a lot more, a lot much, a lot more further to go. So that's partly what drives me. So I practice ethics to the best of my ability. I fail. I do get irritable sometimes, and so on. We all have our failings, but I try to work with them. I'm not perfect. I know I'm not perfect. My teacher wasn't perfect. I know that too. But he was certainly a hell of a lot better than I am as a human being, a remarkable human being, despite his, to me, obvious imperfections, and I knew him very well. I spent well over 20 years living with him. I know him very, very well indeed. Although, of course, he's passed on now. But I've worked with my failings. I'm still working with my failings. I'm happy to have those failings pointed out to me. In fact, I want my failings to be pointed out to me because, like everybody else, like all of you, I have my blind spots. And I need others to help me to reflect myself back to me. And I live upstairs in the men's community and they're brilliant at it. A warning, Adriana. And Michael. but that's fine. We take that in our stride. And it's something which I value. Even though some of the people that I live with have been practicing the Dharma a fraction of the time that I have, they still have something that they can still give me feedback which I can learn from. So that's how I try and lead my life. But the whole thing has been a gradual process. I wasn't always that open to feedback. It was something which gradually opened within me because I was trying to practice ethics. I was making an effort to meditate and I was reflecting upon the Dharma. And in particular, I found it very useful to reflect upon the lakshana, the characteristic of dukkha or suffering or pain or unsatisfactoriness. I imagine most of you have heard about the three characteristics of samsaric existence or life as we know it. Life as we know it is said to be characterized by impermanence, insubstantiality, and unsatisfactoriness. In this series, if you've been coming along regularly, you will have heard us explore those things in a different sort of way. But anyway, if I remember correctly, actually maybe you haven't. Sorry, my short-term memory is shot to pieces. We've done it in the past anyway. But the lakshana, the characteristic of human existence, of samsaric existence, which perhaps I have focused on more, is not impermanence. I've not ignored impermanence, but I've not focused upon it. I've focused more on the fact of the unsatisfactory nature of existence, simply because it impinges upon me more obviously. I can feel it very tangibly. You know, it's very easy to sort of get stuck with ideas about impermanence and with ideas about insubstantiality, that is to say, the ultimate non-existence of the self. It's very easy to sort of have a rather abstract approach and kind of experience of these things. But with dukkha, with the unsatisfactory nature of existence, it's right in your face all the time if you look for it. And so I've always tried to, throughout the whole course of my Buddhist life actually, to make the most of adversity, to try to realize that every time I experience pain, there's probably a reason for it, and probably the ultimate cause is not you, but me. That's one of the biggest lessons to learn in life. Don't blame others. really, it doesn't help you, it doesn't help anybody else. Realize that we are all, ultimately, the authors of our own suffering. Now, of course, sometimes people live in dreadful conditions which for which they're not really responsible. Like, for example, to use an extreme example, people born into the untouchable community in India. So I don't want to sort of make this sound too absolute. In fact, I don't want to make it absolute at all. But by and large, certainly for most of us in the West, the pain that we experience, to some degree, to a large degree, probably, is caused by ourselves. Of course, other people will cause us pain too. And it's useful sometimes it's necessary sometimes to acknowledge that too. But it's probably not helpful to dwell upon it. But it is helpful to dwell upon the fact that we cause ourselves a lot of our own pain. Because then you can deal with that. You can't deal with other people's behaviour, but you can deal with your own behaviour. And that's the key, well, one of the many keys to the Buddhist life. Okay, now all of this is, of course, ongoing, slow, painfully slow, unfortunately, gradual. But by degrees, if you practice long enough, you'll see, and especially when you've been able to look back over a few years, you'll begin to see significant changes in your life. So the pattern of my life has been very much that occasionally there'll be something that might shock me, or it might be quite different. I might be deeply inspired by something, and it'll move me on, it'll shift me on a little bit. And I'll be aware of that there's been a shift. It might be quite a subtle shift, but a subtle shift in my behaviour for the better. And then maybe sometimes there's something quite dramatic happens. Very occasionally that happens too. And again, you can see there's a more significant change taking place. But all this happens very, very, very gradually. So the path, yes, I should come back to my theme. The theme I was asked to explore this evening was, is realization sudden or gradual? And you all know the answer, don't you? Tell me, one more time. Someone, please. There's no sudden penetration to insight. Good. Okay. So I'm going to leave that there. It's not the end of the evening, by the way. Just see if there's anything that I've said this evening which you would like me to unpack a little bit more. I've said quite a lot.